not what most people here think about every day. So I'm going to try to be extremely pedagogical, and please ask me questions and interrupt. And hopefully there will be some relevance to quantum computation of what I say. And if there isn't, forgive me. And if there is, that's great. So we'll decide that together. So, but for me, the motivation for this work is from the ADS-CFT correspondence. So let me just briefly tell you what that is. In very general terms, it's a duality between these two diagrams. That's one diagram, and that's the other diagram. So this one here, I shaded them. This is supposed to be a solid cylinder. That solid cylinder is ADS. In my case, it will be ADS-free, but it could be a higher dimensional ADS. It's some space-time, which is like Minkowski space, but different. And it's some geometry in which which we should consider when we study general relativity. That's all I need to say for the moment. And it turns out that a gravitational theory in this space is equivalent to a theory. So it's important here that this is a theory with gravity. Yes. It turns out that this theory is equivalent to another theory which does not have gravity, and that theory lives on the boundary of this object. So I didn't explain why I draw ADS-free as a cylinder, but it's a common representation and it will not play any particular role in this talk, but that's the picture that usually gets drawn. The one thing I do care about from the cylinder is that it has a boundary, and that boundary is exactly where the CFT lives, and the CFT has no gravity. So you can imagine that if we do have an equivalence of a theory with gravity and a theory without gravity, then any question that you might want to ask about gravity that you don't understand, for example, what happens when black holes evaporate, you should just be able to translate it into the CFT and ask the question there. And much of what my friends and I do is exactly doing that. Some people do things backwards and ask a CFT, a condensed matter question of the ADS side. That's also a very fine thing to do. And the duality is due to Maldacena in 1997. So,
promise to be extremely pedagogical, I will ask a question which I should know the answer. But in which sense how are they dual? What does that mean even?
Well, it just means that for any quantity in the CFT, well, a CFT is really fully specified by its set of correlation functions, which themselves can be followed from some smaller pieces of data. So the idea is that any such quantity can be extracted from just knowing about gravity in ADS-free. And in principle, that should be the case also going the other way around. So any gauge invariant quantity in ADS-free should be defined as in the CFT. And so I have to say what I mean by gauge invariant, but I will actually say that later.
And sorry,
yeah.
Follow up. Can you say, in some sense, this translation should be simple, otherwise I suppose everything is dual to anything else?
No, that's not true, because this is a two-dimensional CFT and this is a three-dimensional ADS. There is definitely no sense in which the seven-dimensional ADS-free is dual to a two-dimensional CFT. So I really object to the statement anything is dual to anything else. No, these things are really dual to each other. Okay.
Is there restrictions on the mapping?
We know a lot about the mapping, and there is only one mapping that's correct. So I guess
the biggest point is if you put enough parameters in a map, you can map whatever you want onto one specific point, right?
Okay, that question is kind of philosophical, and I didn't really want to get into it. The point is that we have some very powerful translator from one set of questions to a different set of questions that look very different. And you're asking, is that an artifact of the dictionary? The answer is no. The dictionary is very robust.
I was asking if there are, to say that things are dual, are there conditions like on the, is it a linear map, for instance, or things like this?
Yeah, it's a linear map. Otherwise, we couldn't. Otherwise, we couldn't do quantum mechanics in one and translate in quantum mechanics in the other. So yeah, it is linear. Sure. No. I mean, we know a lot more about the dictionary than just the fact that it's linear. So, yes.
Yes, it's.
Yeah. So yes, it's linear. If that's the question. Okay. So this. So this duality has a lot of interesting properties, many of which you probably have heard about in or they entered your peripheral field of vision at some point. So one example is the error correcting property. And so let me just tell you what this is. I mentioned that there is a dictionary. Let me focus on this is time, by the way. So let me just focus on an equal time slice of both of these pictures. So that looks like this and that, except that this circle is solid, and this is a ball, and this is an empty circle because it comes from the hollow cylinder. And so if I have an operator which lives in the bulk of this ADS spacetime, that's like here, then you can ask a question, if there's a dictionary, then what is the CFT operator that is dual to that operator? And the answer is that there is more than one such operator. And in fact, Benny is very largely responsible for making that statement precise. So let me divide the boundary of this spacetime into three pieces, and I'm going to call them A, B, and C. Gabriel just spent 45 minutes explaining to us why this is possible. So I'm just going to quote him and say that I can divide it in this way. And then it turns out that this single operator in the bulk of ADS can be represented, for example, as some operator which is smeared in the CFT, which is smeared over the region BC. Or, thank God for colored chalk, it can also be represented as some operator which is smeared over B and A, but not smeared over C. And then there's also another representation of it, which is smeared over C and A, but not over B. And so I have these different representations of the same operator. In the CFT, they're different operators, but from the ADS point of view, they're not. They're really the same operator. So it sounds like the duality is not really very much of a duality because we are going, I just told you that it should be a one-to-one map, and yet it seems like more than one thing here corresponds to a single thing there. And the answer is, we have to be very careful about what we mean by this operator. There is some code subspace in which all of these operators act the same, but then outside of that code subspace, they will act differently. And this is what we mean by ADS having an error-correcting property. And you might say, that's always the case that operators will have the same action on some subspace. The point is that that subspace is a very natural subspace from the ADS point of view. It's the subspace of low energy states there. So that's the error correcting property. Did I say it right, Benny? Okay. So
then one should decode and get rid of CFT and map to the smaller thing that actually relevant, no?
Yeah, that's like reconstructing low energy effective field theory in ADS. That's what that would mean. Okay. Now there is another thing which is a property of the ADS CFT correspondence, which is best explained if I tell you a little bit about tensor networks. And now again, I get to quote Gabriel and say that's possible. So let's say that I have some state in the CFT, for example, the vacuum. So that's the vacuum state in the CFT. And even before knowing about ADS space, I just want to describe the vacuum in some way. And a lot of work was done on that subject precisely in this building. We should build a tensor network that does it. Gabriel told us how to do it in some formal way. But a very pedestrian and explicit way of doing this was largely developed in this building, and this is called the Mera network. So let me draw for you a Mera network. Mera was really designed to capture some properties of the, or actually capture all essential properties of the ground state of a CFT. And it looks like this. And then, so here's the point I want to make about a tensor network. Suppose that this theory here has some global symmetry. I don't have to suppose it, it's true. It's a conformal field theory, so it has a conformal symmetry as its symmetry. Now, let me take a unitary, which is part of the conformal group, and just apply it here as unitary, and here as unitary dagger. Let me apply another unitary, that's a different one, and just apply unitary, unitary dagger. And over here, I'm going to again put unitary, unitary dagger, and they're different unitaries. And then I will group these things into bigger objects, this one, and this one, and this one. And if I do that, this one. So if I group things this way, I will get an a tensor network which has the same structure visually as the tensor network that I started with. But the tensors are different. So what's the difference between them? I have presented these tensors with what I would call a different gauge. Namely, I have applied locally inside the network the global symmetry of the theory and that freedom of choosing the action of of conjugating neighboring tensors by the opposite actions of the global symmetry is what we call a gauge symmetry in the tensor network. Any questions or comments about that? So the punchline of this, of what I just told you, is that a global symmetry in the actual theory is a local symmetry in the tensor network. Now, for the purposes of this talk, ADS-free just acts like a tensor network, which means that a global symmetry here will act as a local symmetry in here, for reasons which are identical to the reasons that I just explained to you in the tensor network language. And that part will be, that fact will be important for us later. Any questions about this or no?
So, sorry, what's the relation between the gauge degree of freedom explanation you just gave and the local global symmetry?
I didn't really talk about the gauge degree of freedom. I didn't say that it's a dynamical thing. It could be, but it isn't in the case of ADS-free.
What's the connection between this picture and the thing you just called global and local symmetry?
Well, this is a local symmetry because I have some symmetry of the whole theory. And I'm going to apply that symmetry to a particular internal bond and immediately undo it. But I'm not applying it to other fields and other bonds in the network, just here. So I'm acting acting locally with the symmetry of the theory on the virtual degrees of freedom that are.
Act with any loop there, right? It doesn't have to be a symmetry.
Oh, excellent. So that's an excellent point. So it's true that I could act with any U here. So it seems like the full symmetry is just the full like U of the Hilbert dimension of the Hilbert space of the theory. And that's technically true. But I would like to be able to take any cut through here and interpret the wave function that I get without including this part of the tensor network as also being a part of the theory, as also being a wave function in the theory. But it's a wave function with smaller number of dangling legs. So I would like to interpret the operation of erasing a layer of the network as RG flow. Uh-huh. And if I do that, then I can only use the symmetries of the theory.
So you want symmetry,
and this RG scale is represented as the radial scale in ADS, and that explains to you why this ADS has one extra dimension, because it's encoding all possible RG coarse grainings of the CFT at the same time. Any questions or comments? Thank you for this question. Excellent question.
I think part of what he's asking is that you're assuming the tensor network that you drew is an extension of the bulk, aren't you?
No. I'm not assuming anything. I drew this for pedagogical reasons, so you would understand on an intuitive level, the otherwise rather arbitrary statement that the global symmetry here is a local symmetry there. This is for illustration purposes only. We can debate on whether this illustration has some real meat to it or not. I've been involved in that debate. It's been going on for a long time, but it's irrelevant to the purpose of this talk. I just wanted to explain this statement, which is in the box. Yeah.
So when you say global symmetry, it should act trivially on the wave function I'm considering?
If it's the vacuum, if it's not the vacuum, then not.
Okay.
So good. And so you might ask, yes?
So just more explanation about this illustrative thing there. So, but it seems to me that you cannot apply these symmetries just to one tensor somewhere in the network, because this U you have to match by a U dagger on the neighboring tensor.
Sure.
Uh-huh. And so you will be applying these symmetries simultaneously on all the tensors. If you start somewhere, presumably.
No, I don't have to. So let's say that I have this piece of network locally.
Yeah.
I'm going to apply a U and a U dagger.
Yes.
And I will never, and I will say that this thing is the same as this, okay? So I just locally changed what I mean by this.
Good.
Okay. So you might ask, so I have this local symmetry here. What is that local symmetry? And what is a local symmetry that a theory with gravity has that other theories don't have? It's diffeomorphism symmetry. It's essentially the symmetry of changing coordinates in the bulk of ADS. So you may or may not recognize it right away when you look at this picture, but the interpretation of doing what Robert just asked about is to locally change coordinates in the in this gravitational description of the theory. That's what we are really doing. So this turns out to tie in with this.
The one dimension somehow related to a space-time dimension, or
the that's a it's like I mean. So for the last several years, there has been a whole industry of people, and I'm very much part of that industry, arguing to what extent it's realistic to associate this line with some particular piece of space-time which is glued together. And so we can talk about it, but for now, let's just treat it as a picture.
Okay.
So, so it's not maybe obvious, but it is true that this property here of the duality and this property here, that local symmetries are global symmetries, that they are actually related to each other. So let me explain how they're related. Let's say that I have an operator like here. This is some local operator in the bulk of ADS. And then I ask, how is it represented in the CFT, so on the boundary? And the answer is, we don't know, because I just told you here is an operator here, but this local symmetry here means that it's meaningless to say the operator is here. This is a gauge-dependent statement, because if I change coordinates, that my notion of here is moving around. Yes? Diffeomorphisms look like they will be moving this pointer, this the point where the operator is applied around. So I need to have some way of what we call gauge fixing this operator. In other words, I have to tie it in some way to the boundary or anchor it to the boundary, and only then it will become gauge invariant. And the way we do it is we, roughly speaking, attach a line to this operator. It doesn't have to be a line. It could be like a network of lines, maybe, that split up in some way. But it could be just a line. And after I have defined this object, which ends at the location of the operator, then that thing is a honestly gauge invariant operator in the theory. Only after I attach it to the boundary does it become gauge invariant. So this thing is called gravitational dressing. But from the viewpoint of the fact that we have this local symmetry, and local symmetry means gauge symmetry, I just remind you it's the same thing. That means that this point has to be attached to a Wilson line of this gauge field, which ends over here. And the Wilson line can be just a single Wilson line, or it can split in some ways. But there must be some combination of Wilson lines that end at this point, and only that combined object, operator, and the Wilson lines leading to it that are gauge invariant. Any questions or comments about that?
I mean, quite obviously, what do you mean by attached to? I mean, I see the.
I just mean instead of writing an operator, I have to say, and do people recognize this expression as a Wilson line? That's a Wilson line. I'll tell you about it more in a moment. But to answer the question specifically, this object is not gauge invariant. This object is gauge invariant. Okay, so I just have to attach it to something. And that something is a Wilson line of this gauge field that I have here. And that gauge field is the gauged global symmetry of the boundary theory. At least it can be, yeah.
So the first object, is it just consists of a matrix or?
Which object? This one?
No, the second one.
The second one.
Yeah.
Well, I have, so in general, I have to do some kind of gravitational dressing. It's probably not the only way to do it, but one way to do it is to take this gauge field, which is the gauged version of a global symmetry, and take a Wilson line out of that and lead it up to that point. That's the.
Which is made of what? Is it made of like metric?
It's made of metric and maybe the spin connection. In the particular case of ADS3, it will be made of the metric and the spin connection. In other cases, it may be made of more general things. Yeah. So why does this explain our error correcting property? It explains it because if I have to dress this operator, then I can dress it in the white way, or I can dress it in the orange way, or I can dress it in the blue way. And now you understand why there are these different representations of the same operator. You see, I had to connect it to the to the boundary, but there are many ways to connect it to the boundary. And once I connect it to the boundary, the different ways of connecting to the boundary are different from one another. These are the different CFT avatars of the same Lorentzian effective operator in the bulk of ADS. And so that's why this property is actually tied with that property, which is error correction.
Sorry.
Questions or comments?
Yeah, you seem, okay, what you just said, you seem to be tying up these Wilson lines to regions that can be error correct. But you also just told us that you could have a single line. And if I, you know, interpret this in the error correcting language, it seems like
that's
something too strong.
That's true. So I, good. Yeah, if I just attach it with a single line, then it will act like this operator with when put in correlation functions with some small subset of other operators, but not the full one. When I spread this Wilson line network in a better way, then it maybe I will be able to generate an operator that acts like we want the bulk operator to act with in correlation functions with all bulk other operators. So it's a question of the quality of the approximation of this bulk object. Okay.
Can
so,
I ask another question for clarification? So where these funny trees of Wilson lines live, also these tree-like networks live. So are they the same thing or are they different things? Is this happening in these slices of your ADS?
Is this one happening?
Is one of them the same thing or is this in parallel?
The way I said it, it sounds like it's the same thing, and it is, but I'm just not prepared to say yes, because maybe someone who's watching it online will say no, and then I'd have to defend it. So roughly speaking, it's that, but I reserve to modify the picture in the face of technical questions. But on a qualitative level, the answer is yes.
Okay. Can I ask if the manifold is closed, there's no boundary, how would the picture change this?
Oh, if the manifold is closed,
then you have
and
a specific boundary.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I would never be talking about this because then there wouldn't whatever symmetries I have here wouldn't be avatars of any global symmetry. So then I shouldn't be setting up the discussion in this way.
Oh, but you can fit a theory with on a closed manifold and also put bounding.
Sure you can.
So is there a correspondence?
I'm not. So my only answer to that question is I'm not trying to give you a whole sweeping answer to all questions. Also, there is a reason why we have an ADS CFT correspondence, but we don't really have a DS CFT correspondence. And the biggest reason is basically that one. There isn't a boundary that we can use in at least in Euclidean settings, because Euclidean DS is a sphere.
Okay, so
the key, maybe the one meta thing that I really want you to get out of this whole introduction is some general sense, two things. One is some general sense of what ADS CFT is about, but the other one is the importance of these Wilson lines, yes? This Wilson lines, or this type of object, is the key thing that allows us to properly define what we mean. And these Wilson lines are path-ordered exponentials of this local symmetry that I have in the bulk. That's the thing. These are the things that you need to get out of this. So a general question you can, I made the point about error correction being related to this. So you can say, is there a way to set up error correction in the language of Wilson lines and gauge theories? I don't have anything to say about this, but I pose it as a problem to all of us, maybe. But I will have a little bit to say about the problem of setting up computations in the sense of the circuit model of quantum computation in the language of these Wilson lines. And so that's what I want to tell you about next. So my talk is ostensibly about ADS CFT, but I hope that the content of it is translatable into the model, or the circuit model of quantum computations. So the next thing I want to tell you is I want to put some to get more specific. So here I've been talking about ADS3 and CFT2, and I say a global symmetry is a local symmetry here. So let's be a little more specific and actually talk about that symmetry in detail. So in the ADS3 case, in the CFT2 case, the global symmetry, which is preserved by which acts globally on the system, is the global conformal group in two dimensions, which is SO2,2. You may remember that the conformal group in two dimensions is larger than that, but this other symmetry, the larger thing, is a local symmetry, and we precisely want these global things to be gauged, so I won't be talking about the other, yeah, about the larger components of the conformal group. But just this SO2,2, it is equivalent under some, it is isomorphic to SO2,1 cross SO2,1. And it's that symmetry, two copies of SO2,1. What's happening?
I'm just making photos of you.
But I'm very self-conscious now. So it's these.
Don't you have a phone?
No, that's my problem.
It's being recorded.
I am asking for more time due to these distractions. Okay, this is. So I have this. So these are this is the symmetry, and evidently this cookbook prescription tells me that I should have a gauge symmetry in ADS3. I should have a gauge field, and that gauge field should be valued in SO2,1. It should be an SO2,1 gauge field and an SO2,1 gauge field. So evidently, I will need two SO2,1 gauge fields without making a particular commitment to how this ADS3 is parametrized. Let me just say that there will be a coordinate which is called U. There'll be a coordinate which is called X minus. And there'll be another coordinate which is called X plus. I'm just setting some names for free coordinates for this ADS free space. And so what does it mean that I have two connections which are SO2,1 connections or two SO2,1 gauge fields? Let me just give you an example of it. So it has to be a connection which has components X minus, X plus, and U, and and those components have to be valued in the Lie algebra of SO2,1. And of the other SO2,1. So an example choice of such a gauge connection, I'm just making a choice here, is dx plus plus u plus L0 du over u. It's just an example choice. And the other one will be L plus 1 dx minus over u minus L0 du over u. So why is this a reasonable choice? I mean, why is it an allowed choice? It's an allowed choice because every component of this gauge field, the x plus component here and the u component here, the x minus component of this one vanishes, are some elements of the SO2,1 Lie algebra. Maybe you don't recognize this fact because you've never seen the L minus 1 and L0 and N plus 1. So let me just tell you a little bit about it. What they are, they form, so L 0 and L plus minus 1 are generators of the algebra, of the Lie algebra of SO2,1. And they are just like polymatrices, roughly speaking. They are polymatrices in the sense that if you think about what polymatrices do for SU2, yes, SU2 is the same at the level of the algebra as SO3. And here we have SO2,1 instead of SO3. And so whatever the polys are doing, sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z, to generate this Lie algebra, these guys should be doing to the SO2,1. And the idea is that there is some analytic continuation that will map them to one another, because that analytic continuation turns SO3 into SO2,1. So if you want to specifically know so whenever you see L minus 1 or L0 or L plus 1 here, you should be thinking that it's an avatar of a polymatrix, possibly analytically continued in some way. And specifically, the mapping is typically given in, typically the way we analytically continue one to the other is that we map L0 to sigma z, L minus 1 we map to, let me do it the other way around, because I made some notes, so let me use them. L minus 1 plus L plus 1 will be sigma y and sigma x, and L plus 1 minus L minus 1 will be minus I sigma y. So I analytically continued one particular polymatrix to generate one combination of these conformal group generators. So whatever I do with these gauge fields, You should think of this as I'm basically doing something like SU, and SU like a spin a block sphere transformation, except that one direction of on that block sphere is analytically continued. So that's what we're doing. If you hopefully that's a good enough explanation.
So you're applying the SO2-1 part, but like the things like dx over huge, does that reflect the metric?
Oh, they. So I'll tell you how they reflect properties of ADS. But for now, all I said is that because I have a global symmetry in ADS in CFT2, I must have a gauge symmetry in ADS3. So I should be able to choose a gauge field, and I just chose a gauge field. I didn't tell you any properties of that choice. I just told you what it means to even have a gauge field. For example, you write down an equation like this. Okay.
Do you mean for this to be like a spin half representation of the SO2-1, or
well, so here I used the spin 1/2 representation. So yes, but this group will, I mean, this Lie algebra has also a bunch of representations. I'm just saying that we can write down a representation which canonically corresponds to the spin 1/2 representation.
Just doing this as an example, not
just as an example. The real statement is that the whole group is an analytic continuation of SO3.
Okay. And can I also, sorry to, with your time, for your time budget. SO2,1 is non-compact.
That's right.
So these groups cannot have finite dimensions.
That's correct. Excellent. I was going to say that and I forgot. That's right. That's the reason why they have to be represented as functions on some space which has conformal symmetry acting on it. They can be represented as finite dimensional matrices. And so the correlation functions of the CFT will in general be functions of coordinates in the CFT, and those functions of coordinates have to transform under these guys in the way that's, well, in a way consistent with the symmetry. But, and you could say, why do I have to have these functions? Can't I just have matrices? And the answer is no, for the reason you just stated. I need a CFT type of object and not a finite dimensional Hilbert space to represent them. I need a field theory to represent them. So indeed, I just told you what it means to have a choice of connection, but in this particular case, but this choice is looks meaningless until I interpret it in some way. And so the statement is that I can interpret the choice with a choice of metric for this space here. And the metric is this. It's 1/2 of the trace of a minus a bar without coordinates. Or if you want me to use coordinates, I will say it's 1/2 of trace a minus a bar mu and a bar minus a bar mu dx mu dx nu, where mu can be plus, minus, or u. These are the three coordinates I chose over there. So this is a formula that once you plug in these connections into that formula, out will pop up an object which is bilinear in dx mu's and dx mu's, and this is the metric. And you might ask, what is the trace? We're taking the trace in the fundamental representation of SO2-1 that goes back to your question. So that trace is trace L0 squared is 1/2, trace L minus 1, L plus 1 is 1, and all other traces vanish. So now with these prescriptions, what I mean by trace, I completely told you what the metric will be. So let's see what the metric is here. The metric will be dx plus dx minus plus du squared over u squared. And this is the metric of pure ADS free space. So that's a choice of A, which gives me this metric, that gives me this space. And the key thing about this is that you give me this metric, but I can say, oh, this metric came from some choice of connection, and somehow Wilson lines of that connection are going to be essential for making things gauge invariant here, and maybe they'll be essential for other purposes too, if I manage to convince you of that. Although in 5 minutes, probably that won't happen. I think it's useful to demystify what Wilson lines is just because now it sounds like I have this very abstract and big word which I'm throwing around and I'm trying to convince you that it's so important, but what actually is it?
Yeah.
So for the purposes of complete demystification, demystification of a Wilson line, I want to study something that if you're in this workshop, then you definitely know about it. So here is the Schrödinger equation. So what's the solution of the Schrödinger equation? The solution of the Schrödinger equation in terms of the initial state psi zero is that I have to take an integral of minus I ht dt from the initial time until the final time. And then I have to path order exponentiate it. And that object is the parallel propagator in quantum mechanics. And this is a Wilson line. And so if you don't mind, I'm going to call this form A, and I will say time evolution in quantum mechanics is computed by Wilson lines as well. So that's Wilson lines demystified for you. Now, you might say, that confuses me.
Demystified.
Exactly. You might say, that confuses me even more, because you're telling me that there is a gauge symmetry associated with this where I didn't even know there was one. And the answer is, yes, there is one. Because whenever I write the psi of t, I'm always using some set of coordinates for the Hilbert space when I do that. So what would happen if I had the idea, that's just my wild idea, of always quoting the instantaneous state of the system in a different reference frame in the Hilbert space? I could do that. This is, in the GR language, equivalent to going from the Levi-Civita connection to the spin connection, but adapted to the Hilbert space. And so let's say that I have my Hilbert space H at t plus dt, and then I think of this as a Hilbert space at t up to some unitary transformation, which is u of t. Okay? So if I did this, then I shouldn't be in that language where I'm rotating my Hilbert space as I go in time evolution. It's not okay to just path order exponentiate this guy. Instead, I have to take my connection A, which I remind you is minus IH dt, and I have to transform it by something which corrects for the fact that I'm changing the reference frame. And so that thing is going to be U inverse A times U. Hopefully I put the inverses in the correct place. But that's not enough, because even if the state is not doing anything, I'm still changing the Hilbert. So that would be like the statement that H is zero. But even in that situation, I have to change the coordinates of the state. So I have to add to it that the term which accounts for that, and that term is U dot U inverse, if I'm correct. And you will recognize that this is the transformation law for a non-abelian gauge connection. In the case where this is abelian, so let's say that U is e to the I alpha of t, yes? Then in the case where this is abelian, these U's will just cancel, but here I'm going to have I alpha times U inverse. So this thing will just become I times alpha dot. And in the abelian case, I will have that A goes to A plus the derivative of something. So I will call it d alpha. And this is the more familiar abelian transformation law for a gauge field. But it doesn't have to be abelian. It can be non-abelian, and that's the correct thing. So in the Schrödinger equation, the gauge freedom is the freedom of choosing your coordinates on the Hilbert space. That's what it is. Any questions or comments about this? So in particular, if this guy is a qubit, then this guy here should be a connection one form, which is valued in the SU2 algebra. And so path-ordered exponentials of one forms which are valued in little SU2 in the gauge in the Lie algebra of SU2 are what we mean by the time evolution of a qubit. And if you are doing, for example, the circuit model using qubits, then until you make a gate, a two-way gate, if you're just applying a unitary to a single qubit, you are literally computing or trying to construct a Wilson line of a gauge field like this. And that's part of the things that I wanted to really convey to you. Any questions or comments about that?
I don't choose coordinates when I compute time evolution, by the way. Because you want to, you implied you want to do this. So you said, I mean, when you compute this, you always choose coordinates on the Hilbert space.
Oh, I'm not saying that you always do. I'm saying that this thing is a connection, and when we say that it is a gauge connection, that means that there must be some way of changing gauge. And if you wanted to change gauge, then you would be changing coordinates. You just don't want to change gauge, and that's okay. But that's the statement I'm making. Okay, so if this is SU2, then this picture is literally telling you what a single qubit quantum computation is doing. And I just want to tell you that this object is exactly the same object that was used to well-define objects in the bulk of ADS. And the only difference between them was that one of these things that was part of the definition of the gauge field was analytically continued. That's the only difference between them. So the one thing I would have to do to make this, to say that Wilson lines do all quantum computation, is to allow some two-way gates, for instance, C0, and then I would be done. And so if we're talking about qubits, then what this means is that I have to define an object which merges two Wilson lines and makes them into one Wilson line. And I believe that what Gabriel was telling us about during his first talk was very largely about these types of objects, okay? That he was even drawing pictures like that with pairs of pens and so on. Mm-hmm. And so gates are also part of this picture. I just have to define what I mean by two Wilson lines merging into one. And if you're doing quantum computation, you would just want to define a C0. And if you define this so that its action would be C0, then you would be done. You already have universal quantum computation. In my problem, which is a different problem in ADS space, I have some other constraints that...
Question.
Yeah.
Why not two lines going in and two lines going out? I mean, do you...
I'm just trying to define a minimal set of things that allow me to proceed. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe you would combine two of those guys to have two inputs and two outputs.
I could do that, but this one, I can always decompose it into this. So I can just agree that this is the only object that exists and generate everything else.
Good.
Okay, so that's what I would do. I would make this choice if I was interested in quantum computation, which I am in my spare time. But in my main line of work, I'm interested in ADS CFT. And so I want to define, I had to define a junction of lines so that it would have some meaning in the language of ADS. So I'm going to give you just a lightning summary of how that's done and what the point is, and then I will finish. So the lightning summary of how it's done is that so far I just told you that this, in my gravity problem, that this choice of connection produces this metric. Is there some way of knowing ahead of time that this type of metric would be okay, and this type of connection would be okay for producing this metric, and some other ones would not be? Well, metrics are not just, I don't just get to write them in an arbitrary way, they have to satisfy Einstein's equations. And the statement in this problem is that the resulting metric will satisfy Einstein's equations if these two connections are flat. In other words, if I compute the curvature of these connections, then the curvature vanishes. So the flatness of the connection is equivalent to this being a good metric for me. What is the flatness of a connection? The flatness of a connection means that if I happen to have some Wilson line, okay, for instance, a line like this, a path-ordered exponential of A along this particular trajectory in ADS, that means that I can deform it, and for example, pull it all the way, well, I can deform it in any way I want, and I will always get the same answer. That's the flatness. And in particular, if I have something that's in the bulk, I can deform it back to the boundary, and I will get the same answer. So just at the risk of, if you give me one extra minute of on top of what I was already planning, then I will tell you why that's nice. So let me imagine that I have a connection which says that I want to evaluate this Wilson line. Imagine that these lines are at different values of x plus, but at the same values of u and x minus. Then this path ordered exponential would only pick up this piece, yes? So the Wilson line there is a path ordered exponential from the initial value of a plus, of x plus, to the final value of x plus. And what I'm integrating is this form, which is l minus 1 dx plus over u. Now, you may or may not know this, but this is essentially dx plus. In other words, it generates translations. It generates translations in the conformal group. So this object is, in words, a finite translation by x plus final minus x plus initial over u. Okay? So notice that the Wilson line evaluates to what I would have to do in the CFT to push this point to that point, which is kind of what you would expect. And then when you take that Wilson line and take its expectation value in a primary state or in some other state, that's for the more advanced CFT cognoscenti, then this thing will equal to a two-point function of xf plus xi plus. So these Wilson lines actually compute two-point functions in the CFT, just the Wilson lines. And that's how I know that this object is doing for me everything that the CFT set of observables wants it to do. It's also nice that u shows up in the denominator here. That means that u changes scales. There is some distance between an xf minus xi, but if I had the same Wilson line at different values of u, this thing would be, these points would get closer or farther away from each other, which is the action of the RG, RG that I advertised over there. And u is indeed the RG direction. And that picture kind of confirms that for you. Okay, so in the coming back to the question of defining junctions, because that's what motivated this interlude. So I want to define, so in gravity, I didn't just choose my A's in any way that I wanted. I had to choose them flat. And the choosing them flat corresponds to the deformability of these Wilson lines. So now I need to define a junction. So a natural thing to do would be to say, I want to define a junction so that this thing is still deformable, so that this junction is the same as this junction, yes? That would be a very natural way of choosing junctions so that I don't break the features of the theory that are already there. And choosing this in the CFT language is equivalent to setting the junctions to enact the OPE expansion in the CFT, which is, if you know CFT, that's the most basic thing you could imagine. The analog of this in the SU2 language would be like choosing the outgoing Wilson line to carry a state given some two input states, given by the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients of it. It's basically the addition of angular momentum, except we're doing the addition of analytically continued angular momentum, and that's what gives us this this deformability of Wilson line networks. When you choose junctions and Wilson line networks in this way, I emphasize that this is a choice, then this thing, so a Wilson line computed a CFT two-point function. This thing will compute a CFT three-point function. And this thing will compute a CFT six-point function. All point functions of the CFT will be computed by networks of Wilson lines. And so that's what we do. The motivation for me in doing this work initially was the question, what is the complexity of a state? And there have been, you probably have heard about this in various places. There are conjectures that the circuit complexity of a state corresponds to either the volume or the action inside some region in ADS. Well, it turns out that this picture makes very definite contact with the complexity equals volume conjecture. The way it does that is that, suppose that I consider the following object. it's a Wilson line network, which had a bunch of Wilson lines coming into it, and then I cut them. This is a functional which takes a bunch of Wilson lines and sends them to real numbers. So it acts in the same way as trace O, yes? It sends an observable and sends it to real, takes an observable and sends it to real numbers. So I say that in this Wilson line language, this is what we call the state. And then this state, evaluating the output of this functional from observables to real numbers, means that I just have to go through these tensors on the way. And so I would associate complexity with how many tensors, how many truncated legs I have in this diagram. It turns out that there is an argument for counting the number of legs, and the number of legs as a density of it per unit length on this curve is equal to the extrinsic curvature of the curve itself. If that's true, then the number of legs, which is the total complexity, should be given by an integral of KDS. And by the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, this is equal to the volume inside plus an extra 2 pi. And so with that input, which I didn't explain to you at all, the complexity turns out to be the volume in agreement with the volume proposal for complexity. So this was a detour for those who care about ADS, CFT, and complexity conjectures. But maybe for you, the more interesting part is think about these types of Wilson line networks, such as this one, as instances of quantum computation. Change the gauge group from SO21 to SU2, and you have a qubit circuit model of quantum computation. And maybe that's useful for something. Thank you.
Yes, we have lots of questions, but do you have any questions?
Ask a very broad question. In terms of all of these developments in understanding this, has anything helped in extending this framework to different theories of gravity beyond ADS3?
Not so far is the answer. So there are some people, among them, some of them in this building, like Will Donnelly, is he still here? Or,
yeah.
Yeah, who are experts on this issue of gravitational dressing. So they would be the better addressee for that question than me. I know this ADS-free case the best because it's the cleanest for various reasons. And I'm sure that there are messy analogs for let's say, higher dimensional versions of ADS, but they won't be as clean as this.
I have a question about your concluding sentence, which is also on various places on the boards. So let's go up there where you did your analytic continuation. So you have these L operators, and if you presenting SO2,1, and you analytically continue them, and you're getting the Pauli operators. So now what if from that point you tried to go all the way back, but you take kind of a different turn? You do not analytically continue, but you stay with the Pauli operators. What kind of space would you be ending up with? You said earlier, okay, we need the A in the ADS-CFT correspondence because without the A in ADS, it wouldn't work. So when you go all this way back to the gravity side, if that's possible, what space do you end up with?
So if I didn't do this and applied this, then what would I get is the question. And I believe that I would get the standard metric on the Bloch sphere, like remind me what the name is, the Fubini study metric, I guess. That's probably what I would get. The only thing I can get by symmetry, so I'm sure that that's how it works.
So let's end this.
Thank you very much.